Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your Owlpost for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is every single week, the incredibly talented and just wonderfully funny Drea Kaufman, who had me in stitches right before we started recording.
Well, because I almost clicked the wrong button and just like ended everything instead of the one that's like, go! So that's just a good summary of where my mind is right now, y'all.
This is why they don't give you the nuclear launch code button, because, you know, you might accidentally just end it all.
It'd have to be very clearly labeled for me. And even then, if it's the same color, y'all were screwed.
It looked like the easy button.
Well, like both the end meeting button and the record button are red. Like, yeah, I just looked for the red thing.
Well, we are excited to be here to talk about Chapter 12, Professor Umbridge. But before we get into the chapter this week, don't forget, check us out wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure you're subscribed. Also, give us a star rating review over there in iTunes, Apple Podcasts. Help people find the show. Star rating reviews make a big difference in who finds the show when we, you know, people search for Harry Potter podcasts, so that really helps. You can also find everything that we do social media-wise over on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. And the website, thenerdparty.com, where you can find out everything that we're doing Nerd Party-wise. We have so many different podcasts that you should be checking out, so do that. And while you're there, maybe you'd like to send us an email. So Drea and I will get that if you go to thenerdparty.com/contact, choose a show, choose Owlpost, and then we'll be able to converse with you that way. So
what I'm hearing is you really have no excuse not to tell us what you think.
Exactly.
Did I understand that correctly?
That's pretty much it. Yep. Yeah, we can, and one of the things that we love is to talk to you. I mean, we've gotten some great tweets from people talking about our episodes. You know, we've had great conversations on Facebook. We've had some good emails. And so, again, we love hearing from you, what you think. And so, yeah, please do reach out to us because it makes it a lot of fun to get to interact with the people who listen.
It's totally true.
Not so fun for Harry, though, at the beginning of this chapter. So
this chapter is not my favorite chapter either. It's important, but it's definitely not one of my favorites.
I agree with you. It is kind of a hard chapter, especially when you get to the very end of it, where we actually are in Umbridge's classroom, but we'll leave that to a little bit later.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah, just hold your horses. Gosh. Oh. One of the things that I think is interesting is how, you know, Harry waking up in the morning and Seamus is like, top speed, he's out of there, and you know, everybody else is like, don't worry about it, Harry, it'll be fine, you know.
I do love the description, though, like, he's out there and they only caught the, like, wisp of his robe out the door. Like, I like the way she put that, because it does really show you the, like, sense of urgency he had in getting out.
It's interesting because Harry's having this kind of monologue inside where he's like, I just don't know how much more of this I can take. You know, like, we keep putting the pressure on Harry. In many ways, I almost feel like Harry's in a pressure cooker. This book, you know, and the
especially
pressure,
like, just right about now.
Yes, which is why he keeps kind of exploding at people. Because
for our British or non-American fans, he's in like a kettle.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of reminds me. So every morning I make coffee in a Chemex, which is kind of like a pour over. I love it. But, you know, every morning I use the tea kettle to warm up water. And I really do feel as though, you know, Harry is that, which every time he gets too hot, you know, he just kind of has to spew out all of the steam and let go. And then he can kind of reset. And then something else happens and the pressure builds and it all comes out again. And I feel really bad for him because he's in this place where, and this whole book is really going to be about more and more pressure building on Harry, and it's not going to end anytime soon. And so, luckily, though, I mean, he's not the only one who's got pressure, because Hermione's trying to pressure Ron to talk to the twins about their little project that they've got going on there in the Gryffindor common room.
Before we even see that sign, when they go downstairs, Harry mentions the fact that, you know, he sort of had this run-in with Seamus, and Hermione says something to the effect of, like, you know, Lavender said the same thing. And he just jumps down her throat, kind of like he was doing when he first got to the Order of the Phoenix headquarters. And Hermione finally sort of steps up, and she's like, and I would really appreciate it if you stopped doing that, because we're on your side and you have to just, like, give us a break. And he was kind of taken aback by how bluntly she put the fact that he's jumping down her throat. And he takes a moment and he's like, yep, I'm sorry. And she's like, that's all right, we'll move on. Like, it wasn't like she was making a big deal out of it. And I always loved this moment every time I read this book and every time I watch this movie, because it's so often women get sort of portrayed as, like, overly emotional and, like, super, you know, like, into that, like, just fixated on that. And this is the moment where she is very just to the point. She just says exactly what she's thinking and feeling. And Harry's the emotional one, and it's kind of a turn on, like, what you'd think of in gender roles, where she should be really hurt by it. And really, she's just being very matter of fact, like, I've had enough. Please just stop. We're good to go. And I always really appreciated that little moment, because you don't always get it, and you don't always get it from female characters specifically. And I thought that it's just a great little way of turning those stereotypes on their head a little bit, without making it into, like, a big thing.
What I love about that, too, is that, you know, we've seen the emotional toll that it has been taking on her and Ron, you know, and it's not just her, right? She's saying, yeah, can you please stop jumping down our throats? Like, Ron, yeah, and I are on your side, you know, get a grip, bro. If you want to yell at somebody else. And I think that
almost
that's
verbatim. That's the modern, yeah, interpretation.
Yeah, pretty much.
Get a grip, bro.
Yeah. Simmer down, bro. What I really love, though, is that she ties this into the conversation that we had last week about the way that this is exactly what Voldemort wants. He wants, mm-hmm, people fighting. He wants this infighting. He wants this discord. He wants this enmity. And that this is exactly what Dumbledore had been talking about, and what the Sorting Hat was saying, is that if we're not united, we're going to, you know, be screwed. And Ron and Harry are just like, yeah, we're, you know, if that means we're going to get, you know, all chummy with the Slytherins, that ain't ever going to happen. And Hermione's like, look, we either do this or we're going to be in real trouble. And I think I just love the fact that this book thematically, she's really building that into things here. And the fact that within the first few chapters here of us being back at Hogwarts, we're already seeing exactly that. And it's a little bit scary to see that.
How easy it is to disrupt that. And the moment that they have between, you know, Ron and Hermione have here, where, don't you remember Dumbledore said last year, and, you know, what the Sorting Hat told us this year, and he's like, how do you remember these things? And she's just like, he's like kind of in awe of her, and she's like, I pay attention, and just like moves on and totally doesn't see it at all. And it's just like a little moment where you're just seeing the admiration he has for her and how important her role is in the Trinity. And, you know, she remembers these things, and everyone else is like, I don't know how you do it. And she's just like, it's not a big deal. But, you know, honestly, that is a talent she has. And it is something that some people just have a really great memory and others have a terrible memory. And it just shows that, you know, she remembers kind of for everyone.
The biggest part is that Hermione just listens to things, you know, like she really takes in what she hears, because she's actively listening, because, mm-hmm, she's one of those people who just loves learning. Whereas, you know, Ron and Harry are very guilty of being kids who still in that kid mode of like, this is boring, I don't want to learn this, you know. They even talk about that with Professor Binns' class later about how boring it is and like how they can't pay attention in it. And Hermione's like, you could if you wanted to. And like, no, not really. You know, and so Hermione does have this basic, almost this superpower. And it's not really a superpower. It's just the fact that she cares to learn whatever, yeah, it is. So, you know, the boys don't have that at the moment with some things. And so, yeah, Hermione is very important to this Trinity.
Yeah, and then we get her natural Hermione-ness peeking out and her wanting to chastise the twins for posting in the common room for testers for their little treats or their joke shop that they are working on.
Well, and I just kind of love that because Ron wants no part of that. And, you know, Hermione's like, it's our job. We're prefects. This is what we're supposed to stop, this kind of thing. And I just love how this whole chapter, Ron's pretty much doing all he can to get out of that, which is classic Ron.
It is really funny. And I do love that Hermione's like, it's just matter of fact that this is what we do. And he's like, ugh. But he doesn't say no, and he doesn't say anything against it. And that later on in the chapter, when she kind of calls them on it, he's just like, I have no part in this. I am not here. I am not saying I am not involved, you know? And I think part of that's because it's his brothers, and he, you know, there's a part of him that probably doesn't want to risk upsetting them the way that he's sort of already lost contact with Percy and things like that. We hear a little bit more about how the twins feel about that as well. But I do love that there's a part of him that just wants to avoid the responsibility. And then there's really a part of me that does think he is trying. You know, he's trying to preserve something that, he's a little afraid to lose. He never thought he would lose part of his family, and he did. So I think there's a part of him that's just being cautious about that. And then there's a part of him that, like, why were you made a prefect? You were never going to challenge something that you like, even if it's against school rules. So it'll be interesting to see how he sort of handles that.
The other thing that I think is really fascinating is a little bit later in the chapter and just kind of connected with this storyline is the fact that they, you know, they have a talk with the twins, and the twins are talking about, because they're discussing the OWLs, the ordinary wizarding level tests that they have to take this term. And the fact that, you know, they're not even sure if they're going to be back for their seventh year because they think they might open a joke shop, which brings back up the subject of where they're getting this money. And Harry is just like, I can't change the topic fast enough, because puts him in a really awkward position. But out of that, we learn two really interesting things. One, school is going to suck this year for these kids in this fifth year. And two, you know, the twins have more money than people realize they have.
Well, and I actually really like this mechanism she has of, like, testing, right? This sort of standardized wizarding testing. It makes it really relatable. And I really love that the names that she gives her assessments, the OWLs, and the twins were talking about the next year's tests of the newts. I think it's just so clever and really, it's just cute. And it makes the situation all that more relatable for anybody who has had to endure standardized testing of any sort, how difficult and strenuous and just ridiculous it can be.
Well, and I really liked that too. I think you bring up something that's really interesting because, you know, the OWLs here are also linked to where the kids will go next in terms of what they'll do in the last 2 years, but also what they will do possibly job-wise, which is really fascinating. You know, we are really, you know, what I think is neat here about Hogwarts is that Hogwarts is, and it seems like the wizarding education here is very much set up to be not just this theoretical place, right? It's a very practical place where we are preparing students for what comes next, which will come into play when we get to the very end of the chapter and what Dolores Umbridge is talking about. So there's this real sense here, though, that what they do this year really affects the rest of their future. And I think
I would also be really interested along those lines of anyone who has attended primary or grade school in, like, Great Britain or France or something, if sort of career aptitude or long-term career planning is a part of the sort of, like, education system. Is this something she's pulling from the real world and is commonplace there? Or because it's, I think that there's a thought that it should be a commonplace here in the United States, but it's definitely not a focus and it's definitely overlooked. And there's no sort of, like, planning done in that. You're sort of left to your own devices. So I'm just curious if that happens over there, especially in like a boarding school or something like that? Do they sort of help you determine career path or assess how, you know, what classes you should take based on, you know, aptitude in previous classes or what? So if anyone out there has that experience, I would actually be really, really interested to hear about that. So just a side note.
No, I totally agree. I think that would be really cool, especially since there's a short conversation that does happen with Ron and Harry in this chapter about what they might want to do after school. Mm-hmm. And Ron thinks it would be kind of cool and he would like to be an Auror. And Harry's like, yeah, that would be cool, which, you know, kind of brings back the whole idea of what Moody brought up last year, or the not Moody brought up to Harry.
Not Moody.
And I thought that that was a really nice tie again to the last book. So, you know, this whole thing, that this chapter has a lot of nice flow to it in the sense that a lot of different parts of the chapter play together. And, you know, kind of going a little bit backwards, but, you know, as they're having breakfast, Hermione has the Daily Prophet delivered, and the guys are like, why are you reading that? And she's like, you know, it's best to know what our enemy is saying. And the best way to do that is to read what they're saying in the newspaper. And I just thought that, you know, Hermione, again, really shows how smart she is, because it is the best way to know the enemy, which is, or just the best way to know anybody. Read what they think, you know, or listen to what they think. Yeah. And I think that's the thing that, again, we were kind of talking about earlier. This is Hermione's kind of superpower, her ability to do this.
Yeah, I think Hermione is, I think if you look at all of three of them, for me, Hermione is the most dangerous one. She seems to be most aware of how to fight, be it socially or, you know, that sort of thing. She is aware of what you need to do to be successful in this sort of, like, it's a little scary how young she is and how comfortable she is with sort of warfare tactics and enemies and things like that. She's the dangerous one in my mind. And maybe not just because I want her to be like the super dangerous Nikita, but, you know, I do think that there's something to be said about the threat that she poses, that I think she's always kind of underestimated because she's this studious girl. But really, she is someone that, you know, followers of Voldemort should probably be looking out for more than they are.
Well, and I think it's one of the places where in this book specifically, I think Rowling is really cementing what the roles of the Trinity are, you know, and where, like, we're talking about this, their kind of superpowers are that are going to, once they unite, you know, it's the Trinity, you know, powers unite, and, you know, that they would be able to do what they will do in the next few books. And so I think really comes to light here with Hermione specifically, but, you know, we're going to see that with Ron some as he grows in this chapter and and in this book. And we're going to, you know, we're going to see Harry do that, as we were talking about earlier, that pressure cooker is going to kind of, in many ways, melt him down like gold. And they're going to take off all the dross and he will be more purified by the time you get to the end here, you know.
Just in case anyone was ever wondering the correct terms for making gold, Matt just told you.
In many ways too, I mean, you know, I've read a few books and one of the things that Rowling is very keen on in her books is the alchemical process, and that much of her writing and all of her writing follows that process. And this book specifically is that process where Harry is going to be melted down and refined. And that's why this book is so difficult for him, because he is being heated up to allow a lot of those impurities and a lot of those frustrations. And really what it is it's a lot of those lingering underlying psychological issues to finally surface from all that's happened to him so that he can deal with them and be able to move forward. Because if he doesn't, there will be no way that Harry would be able to legitimately, psychologically deal with what is going to come next.
Or even just to believe what he is going through and what he, how he goes through it. If we don't have to, if we don't get to see and we're not subjected to the awkward and uncomfortable process, we don't buy it. And I know you and I were talking about that the last time we recorded sort of off air because we didn't want to do any spoilers. And we definitely talked a few spoilers. But I definitely think that if he isn't subjected to some of the awkwardness that this chapter itself and subsequent chapters going forward have, then no one's going to buy. No one's going to care why he's the hero or buy that he's the hero. It makes it not as believable. But to add that element of realism to it and to make it so that you believe he's a person and you want him to be successful, you have to sort of throw him in the frying pan and cook him up and hope that he comes out, you know, tastier on the other end. So I'm hungry, if you can't tell.
I feel bad for Harry because, you know, he keeps having these awkward moments with Cho. And This one is not awkward on his part, but it's made awkward by Ron. Because she's wearing a specific Quidditch badge, team. Quidditch mm-hmm. team's badge. And Ron just starts getting all over her case about why she supports them. Has she been supporting them only since they started winning? Which is definitely a sports conversation. You know, like, look, I live in the Northwest where, you know, the Seattle Seahawks, you know, have been a good team, you know, for the last 6 years. But before that sucked, right? So I'm pretty sure that most of the people that live here, at least half of them, are bandwagoners, right? So, yeah, you take that with a grain of salt when somebody's like a huge fan. So I get what Ron's doing here. But I just love Hermione, like, you have no tact. What is wrong with you?
She's so aware. And Ron is so oblivious. And I feel like that makes it worse for Harry and not better. But it's so funny. I do love that the thought process he goes through afterwards, though. It's so logical. And I am surprised he can think kind of this clearly, even with everything going on. But, you know, he rationalizes through this, like, she could be mad at me. She could easily be someone with those who are kind of against me and don't believe me. I mean, I came out of the forest and her boyfriend didn't, but she's come to me now twice in 2 days and didn't seem to be upset. So, you know, that must mean something. And I love this rationalization he goes through and the fact that it just makes him feel just a little bit better in the long run of that, you know. Yeah, that's kind of like the highlight of his day. And I think anybody who sort of felt that in high school or even older can totally relate to how that would be the highlight of your day.
I love that. I just love that he's like, you know, she could really hate me because she could think I'm responsible for Cedric's death. But apparently she doesn't hate me and she's talked to me twice. So, yeah, I just, like you said, it's so funny that, and I think this is actually Harry's superpower. Harry does, strangely, have the ability to be utterly rational and thoughtful about things and really think things through in a way that most kids his age don't.
Or even some adults,
yeah,
like, could not follow or understand or conceptualize things that way themselves.
Yeah, no, and it's great. I really loved that whole little scene, and I loved Harry's kind of response to it, which made it all the better. We do, at this point of the chapter, we start going through the different classes. They have potions first, which turns out to be awful because Snape is awful to Harry again, which Hermione's like, that was just so unfair. And I love Harry's like, yeah, when has Snape ever been fair to me?
I do like that the sort of, like, he's upset about it, but he's kind of like, eh, I didn't expect anything else, so whatever.
Well, and then it starts this moment where Ron and Hermione just start bickering back and forth, and Harry is just like, guys, shut up! I can't even hear myself think! And he just, like, kind of blows up at them again and leaves them. And I love the moment where...
But it's different, right? It's different this time. He doesn't just snap at him for something that they're not doing. He's legitimately just frustrated. And the fact that they're arguing doesn't help him be less frustrated. Yes. So he sort of snaps at them and is like, I really wish you guys would just stop arguing because I cannot take it anymore. And he has his kind of brutally honest moment with them where he just tells them, like, you guys have to stop fighting. And I am out. And he kind of storms off, like similar to how Hermione told him this morning, you have to stop snapping at us. And it's nice just to know that they have the kind of relationship where they can just be super bluntly honest with each other and nobody takes it personally.
When they get to their divination class, you know, Ron and Harry are still taking that. Hermione is not. And he's like, Hermione and I have stopped arguing, but she thinks it would be nice if you start taking your temper out on us. And he's like, Harry such the, and he's like, hey, just a message, but I reckon she's right because it's not our fault how people treat you. And then he tries to say something again, and then Trelawney breaks in. But again, I think, you know, it's a moment where, as difficult it is for Harry to deal with these emotions, his friends calling him out, and I think rightly so in the sense of, we don't deserve to be treated this way, and would you please stop treating us this way? Like, they're not angry at Harry. They understand what's going on with him. They understand the frustration he's having. Right? They're very understanding, but they're also not willing to take less than they deserve from their friend. And I think it's such a great lesson. Like, you should not let people treat you badly just because they're having a hard time. It's not excusable.
Right. Their actions are not justified by what they're going through. Like, he, you know, just because he's having a tough day, they empathize with that, but that doesn't give him the right to treat them that way. And it's a learning lesson kind of for all of them. But it is. It's a powerful lesson on healthy relationships that we don't often get to see.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I do feel bad.
I do love divination class every time.
I was just about to say that.
I do love divination and how just totally not serious they take this class. Every time we see it, we saw it last book when they started talking about tea leaves and they always made jokes about it. And this time they have this assignment to analyze each other's dreams. And Harry's dreams are very vivid and very specific and a little unsettling. So he really doesn't want to share those in the setting. So I love that when Ron says something about like, oh, I see myself playing Quidditch. He's like, what do you think it means? He goes, maybe that you'll be eaten by like a giant marshmallow.
Yes.
I just died. Because I love how she talks about this and just the absolute ridiculous nature of their reasoning that they come up with. And they get an assignment to do a monthly dream journal, which we learn as they're sort of recanting all of their homework assignments. But I love
that she drops... Which is a lot of homework assignments.
Which does sound like a lot of homework assignments. I don't miss being in high school. But she mentions that they have to do a month-long dream journal, and it actually will come up and become a pretty important part of this book, even though it seems like sort of an asinine assignment.
Yeah. No, it is going to be really fun, actually. I always, like you, I always enjoy when they have divination because I think I enjoy the levity that they get from it most of the time. And that's kind of important in this book. So unfortunately, we've arrived at Defense Against the Dark Arts with Professor Umbridge, who has a very new way of teaching classes, which will be that they will study the principles underlying the defensive magic. They're going to learn to recognize the situations in which that defensive magic could be legally used, and then placing the use of defensive magic in the context for practical use, which means they're not going to do shirt in this class or learn shirt in this class.
But I love that their response is like, what the fork?
Like, it is exactly why, that.
why is this like, and nobody is taking it. Like, no one is accepting it. Everyone is challenging it, including Hermione and Dean Thompson. And like, it's surprising the people who are speaking up, because you expect Harry to be upset about this. You sort of expect Ron to be upset about this, right? But the sheer number and of who she has speaking out, you know that this speaks to a greater issue just than like Harry being angry about things, right? Like, they are genuinely concerned. Especially, was it Pavarti who was like, wait, so you're telling me the first time I get to use this spell is during my test? You're testing me on it, but the first time I get to actually cast it is during my assessment. I just love that everyone is not buying what she's selling. Like, nobody is paying for it. Like, uh-uh. They are on her like white on rice. It's just, I love that we have characters we believe would do that, and that she had them do that, because I would be fuming as well.
Like you said, it isn't just the usual suspects. It's everyone in class is like, what is going on here? Like,
and everyone has a good rational reason. Like, and everyone's not just like, wait, but I want to. They're like, they ask real questions that she doesn't have answers for.
Well, and I mean, I absolutely, like you said, I love that Parvati is like, so you're saying that I don't get to practice this spell, and the only time I get to try to do it is on a test that, like, as we mentioned earlier, will impact what my future will be.
Like, this is, you're telling me that a very important test is the first time I get to do the thing that you're judging me on.
And I think the thing that I mean, this chapter brings home this idea of the way in which education, I think, in many places has been corrupted to be something that doesn't honestly prepare students for anything. We pretend as though we're teaching them important things, but we're really not teaching them anything. We're leaving them kind of, you know, in a canoe without a paddle, you know, like just floating along, and they will then have to follow the current, which is exactly what this administration wants for these children in this class. They do not want children who can in any way rise up against them. They want docile creatures.
Which is just so interesting. And when you think about what we know of Fudge and what we know of how he has treated Harry specifically, it just shows the level of fear that they're at, that they're taking an entire school and jeopardize the learning of an entire and future of an entire student body because they're afraid of children. Of children. Like, we all know, I'm not ruining anything by saying these children are, you know, they're totally amazing and they are much stronger than they get given credit for, but they're still children at this point. And we have, the reason why they become so strong is because we're afraid of them. It's just, it's so interesting.
And I think, you know, that the way that she then frames it to them about how older and wiser wizards have figured out what the whole point of this class is, and how dare you basically challenge the fact that these older and wiser, you know, wizards have spent all the time creating this curriculum. And Harry's like, well, what is that going to do for us in real life? Like, what happens if we're attacked? You know, and she's like, oh, what do you mean if you're attacked? He's like, oh, I don't know, like maybe Lord Voldemort. And like, it just starts this massive fight between her and Harry that is so charged because, and this is the thing that I think that makes it so interesting, you know, and Harry is so righteously angry here because he did stand in that graveyard. He did watch Cedric die. He almost lost his own life. And there's nothing worse than being on the side of what is true and people in your face saying, oh, no, that's not true. That's impossible. You know, like, there is absolutely nothing worse than that. And Harry just, like, has had it at this point.
Well, not just that, but there's just, there's something to be said about discounting your real life experiences and chalking them up to the fact that you're not wise enough or you're not, you know, experienced enough to say that what they are. Like, someone telling you what you should think or feel is just so frustrating. And they're essentially telling him that, like, what he thought he saw wasn't real without any context or processing or anything. It's just, you're essentially telling him he's crazy, which you can't refute. It's just, it's horrible. And you are treating him like a child when he has legitimately experienced things that are so traumatic. Not even adults will go through them. So it's just, they're doing everything they can. And it basically is torture at this point. And as you were referring to earlier, you know, he bursts, he explodes, he sort of just loses it and, like, yells at her. And the way she handles it makes it, like, even more infuriating. Like, you hate her even more because her voice just gets girlier and calmer. And, like, she does the just reacts the opposite that he does, which makes him look so much more aggressive and crazy. And, you know, she writes him this letter that he can't look at and has no idea what it says and sends him to McGonagall's office.
The thing that I thought that she did, which just truly disgusts me, is when she says, you know, Cedric's death was an accident.
Tragic accident. Yeah.
And in this moment, you see exactly what the ministry is doing, which is that they are creating a false narrative that they will hold to for as long as possible. And it creates this just nasty, awful, disgusting thing. You know, I think...
Well, and I think that their lie that they've created, they've made it so good and they've told it so many times that I feel like they genuinely believe it now. They're not lying anymore. That's just honestly what they've convinced themselves happened. Like, it's still a lie, but it now has this feeling of legitimacy because they have told it so many times that I wonder to themselves if they can even understand that it's not real.
Well, I think that's the scary thing too. Like, you can lie to yourself so many times that you begin to believe it. And I think that's the thing that is truly kind of scary here, is this fact that these people are so want to fool themselves that they truly believe their own propaganda. And that is really, really scary. This is what we're up against. I have to say, you know, if you didn't love McGonagall before this, you gotta love McGonagall.
I sure hope you love her now, yeah.
Should I love this?
I love that she has this moment where, like, he goes in and he's like, he's not really sure what to expect, but he's kind of terrified, even though he's just still angry. And he goes in and the first thing she basically does is take the letter and skim it and starts asking him if what's in the letter is real. And, you know, he agrees. And then at the end, she's like, have a biscuit, sit down. And he's like, what? Like, it just throws him off. And he's like, wait, what? She's like, have a biscuit and sit down. And, like, she's calm. She's not, clearly not happy, but, like, she's not angry. And you're like, what is happening? And he describes it as too similar to the time that he was in her office when he got caught in the very first book flying when he wasn't supposed to be flying. And then she offers him a spot on the Quidditch team. So he's like, I don't know what to think is going to happen.
It's pretty great. And I love, too, that she's like, you need to be careful, Potter. And he keeps kind of, like, ratcheting up her tension to the point where she finally yells at him, like, do you really think that this is about truth and lies? This is about keeping your head down and your temper under control. And that she's like, did you not hear Dolores's speech? And he's like, Yes. What he's do you like, think it meant?
He's like, mumble, mumble, mumble. Get a few things out,
yeah,
mumble.
It's kind of like an Aquaman where he's like, I don't know, something, something, trident. You know, like, she's like, Harry's pretty much like, something, something, ministry interference. And I love that.
She just knows.
Yes.
I love that she knows. And she's like, well, at least you listen to Hermione.
Was such a fantastic way to end the chapter that, you know, she's like, I'm so glad you get listen to Hermione. Now get out of my office.
Well, I was like, at least you listen to Miss Granger. Now get out. Like, okay, you're not going to listen to me. At least there's someone you listen to. Just heed my advice and get the hell out of my office.
Well, and I just love, I mean, because this is one of the moments where you really see the way McGonagall cares for Harry, I think. I think this is one of those moments where you see the extra care that she's taking with him. And I think she understands in many ways the hard time that he's going through. But she also has, I love her because she also has her own limits of patience. She's not quite as patient as Dumbledore. And, you know, after so many years of dealing with kids, even more years now, if we're taking into account what we know from Fantastic Beasts, just listen and get out. Like, it's great, which is very much like, you know, when your mom used to get mad at you and be like, okay, fine, just get out.
I do like, though, that it has a motherly quality, you know, like we have Molly as a motherly character, but this is kind of a different motherly feeling, right? This is not a overly protective or overly sensitive kind of maternal instinct. This is more of a tough love maternal instinct that she looks out for him and cares for him, but isn't sort of overly emotional or invested in it. You know, giving him guidance and hoping that he listens to the guidance and understands that this is bigger than himself. And that she's providing this sort of guidance that he gets. But yeah, I love that she sort of has her limits and snaps a little bit. And it's just like, I see, I would totally do that. I'd be like, are you listening? Get out. Like, it's great. And that's, you know, one of the moments that you gotta love McGonagall. But it's a warning that there is more going on here than meets the eye. And we're just hearing time and time again how different of a climate and an environment we're in now than even, say, a whole book ago. This is definitely the tipping point for everything. And you know, this is her, if there was ever any doubt as to sort of her being involved in the Order of the Phoenix, ever since we sort of saw her come through the room and leave, you know, this is just more evidence that they need to be careful on what they're doing. I loved it, though. She is by far one of my favorite characters in everything.
Yeah, I'm really interested, you know, because, you know, next week we have some detention with Dolores coming up. So that should be an interesting chapter for us to get to. But before we dive into that delightful chapter, Drea, where can people find you if they want to catch up with you about all things Harry Potter, all things going on with all of these days, and all things how much we love McGonagall?
You can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram and Letterboxd and Tumblr all under the name MountRushing02. I'm here in the network doing aggressive negotiations with John Mills. Every week we talk about a new Star Wars topic that we've been thinking about. It's a lot of fun. I hope you check it out. In fact, we are hitting episode 150 as this episode drops of that show.
Woo!
So yeah, not bad. And then I'm over on the Trek FM network. I do a couple of shows there. One is called The Orb with Chris Jones talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And then I'm also doing the 602 Club with Chrissy Morris as we talk all about the fandoms we love that don't have anything to do with Star Trek, because there are so many fandoms to love. So make sure you check that out. And then last but not least, you can find me doing a show called Cinema Stories, and I do that with my good friend Courtney as we talk about films through the lens of faith. But thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Thank you.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.